Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Assen, the Cathedral of Speed. The MotoGP race takes us into the second half of the 2022 season. And we have just seen the factory Ducati rider Pecco Bagnaia run away with the race victory. However, would he have done just the same were it not for big drama between championship leader and reigning champion Fabio Quartararo, who came to blows early on in the Grand Prix with Aleix Espargaró? What could have been come the flag? Toby Moody here with Simon Patterson and Valentin Hurunci to talk about Pecco Bagnaia back on the box in first place with a perfect race. Quartararo's admission of a rookie crash that got him a long lap penalty for the next race, the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. Marco Bezzecchi takes the first podium in MotoGP for the VR46 team. A little bit of history there. And we're going to touch on Aprilia. They could have won that with Aleix Espargaró. Well, I just think that would have been a classic showdown at the final chicane that we've seen for so many years. Simon, we've seen it in World Superbike. We've seen it in World Supersport. We've seen it in Moto3, Moto2, MotoGP. I think that was going to be a cracker. What a shame those two came together. But Bagnaia is going to take the 25 points anyway.
I don't think it would have been a cracker, actually. I think that what we saw from Aleix Espargaró once he rejoined the track in 15th and came through the pack meant that he was going to clear off. I think that he had something special in the bag on Sunday. I don't think we've ever seen that sort of pace from Aleix before. We've never seen him riding a MotoGP bike like that, but he looked incredible. He looked unbeatable, actually, despite the fact that he was having to do it from so far back. And I guess the good thing is that we did get our last corner, last lap showdown. It was just for fourth and not for first, with what has to be one of the finest overtakes I've ever seen, to make a pass that aggressive, but also that clean, as he did on Brad Binder and Jack Miller at once. Yeah, superb work. And that, to me...
And risky.
Yeah. Absolutely risky, but I think he was in a different mental state yesterday after getting bumped off the track. He admitted that in his debrief, kind of jokingly, that if he had crashed, he realized that the worst thing that could have happened would be that him and Fabio both wouldn't score points. And he said once he got into the top 10, he realized that there was a chance for real points, a chance to really close down the championship. And he said, he joked that he knew at that point that if he crashed again, it was going to be Fabio's fault, not his own fault. So he had nothing to lose. And that's why we saw those overtakes, those phenomenal passes. I think he said all of them came in Geert Timmer chicane. He said he passed every rider in the last chicane. And it was all because the Aprilia is so good through the previous, that fast left kink, that he was carrying so much speed into it that he could just do things that no one else was able to do there.
So I've reviewed Aleix's race in its entirety, and there was one pass, not at the Geert Timmer chicane, it was at the right-hander before Ramshoek, before the Geert Timmer chicane. He passed Zarco as if Zarco was standing still, which Zarco's race was basically standing still anyway. But yeah, the rest of them were all very similar moves into the chicane that seemed really, really easy because he was carrying insane amounts of speed through that final sector. Looking at the sector times, I think Fabio could maybe do the same thing in that final sector. But we didn't get a proper look at Fabio's pace because he broke his bike immediately. But I think that if there was a duel, that might have been it, honestly. But it's all conjecture at this point, and only one of them got to have a race for the ages, and that was Aleix. It was an exceptional performance, and I think it's one that will really, like, wherever the season goes from there, I think it's one that I described it as legacy making in a headline today, and I think honestly, I would argue it's more legacy making than his Argentina win, because you know Argentina was a fairly straightforward win, whereas this it's something to talk about, something to remember.
Yeah, look at all the races that Valentino Rossi won over the years, and the ones that stand out were the ones that came with truly exceptional performances, not the ones that won him titles or the ones that he won by 30 seconds. It's Laguna against Stoner, it's Jerez versus Gibernau. Those are the ones that you remember, and Aleix Espargaró had his first one of those ever, I think, on Sunday.
So after he had been through the gravel, he lost 8.5 seconds or so on that lap. Let's not forget that Aleix Espargaró started fifth, eventually finished fourth, including that 8.5 second run, Val, on that lap. But he's got dirty tyres, he's angry. But to settle himself down and to not be hot-headed, which of course he's got form for, is just another ride of the day. One of the rides of the year, even?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, and it's... It's really one for the ages. Obviously, he had the pace to. I think it would have been like maybe the unquestionable ride of the year if he was passing people at more than just Geert Timmer, because it looked like he had a plan that he was executing every single lap with very little trouble. But no, it was excellent, and it's excellent that he didn't let it get to him. That he rode very precise, very fast. That he. Honestly, I'm a little bit surprised by the amount of risk taking, especially in the final lap, because if that went wrong, then you're still at 34 points back from Fabio. And if that goes right, I mean, that's a couple of points. But at the same time, I guess when you're fighting in a title battle with Fabio, you do have to make every point count, even now, even with 9 races to go. And he did, and it was excellent. It was a joy to watch.
And that for me is the reason why it is the ride of the year, because it's the first race this year, the first ride this year from Aleix that has looked like the sort of ride that wins you titles. Winning in Argentina was great and all that, but there wasn't that same sense of sort of exploiting a rival's weakness and pulling back something. And you know,
he won it on Saturday night, Simon.
He did.
He was hot.
Exactly.
Favorite, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, Martin gave it a good go.
Sunday was different. Sunday felt different. It felt like him sort of putting it on the line for that title. He wasn't thinking about the title in round 3 in Argentina. He didn't even think it was possible then. You know,
not very many of us did. Not very many. Not none of us. None of us. Not very many. I mean, there's something about coming back from the back. Brad Binder, Moto3, Jerez, back of the grid, won the race. Nobby Ueda did it at Suzuka in early 90s. It can be done, because there's an element of psychology in the rider's brain of, do you know what, I'm just going to rag it. I'm just going to go for it. And everything clicks. And I saw a lot of that happen yesterday with Aleix, which is, and it was controlled anger rather than hot-headed anger, in my view. Val?
I don't know if there's a difference. I think it's just a matter of, like, millimeters and stuff. Mark Marquez's anger looked very controlled at Jerez when he went from 15th to 3rd and on the back of Maverick Vinales at the start of 2020. Then he chucked it in the gravel, broke his arm. I don't know. It's, you know, it's risk versus reward. And Aleix was on the right side of that yesterday. But when you pass two bikes into the chicane on the final lap, that can always, there's always a chance that it goes wrong one way or the other. He played the odds, and the odds came out in his favor. And you know, fair game. I'm not complaining there. I don't know that, like, that particular part did not look massively controlled to me. It looked risky as all hell.
You know the old line about there being a really fine line between genius and insanity?
Yeah.
I think Aleix was 1 foot on each side of the line yesterday.
Yeah.
I hope Pecco Bagnaia isn't listening to this podcast, because, Pecco, we must not forget that you won the race and you were hardly ever headed. So from your fourth pole of the year, he sped away. No one kind of saw which way he went. That's what the history books will say. The crash will kind of fade into the distance. We'll never know. We could talk about this, if, buts, and whats. Could he, should he, whatever, have won it. But it is what it is. And he's taken a victory. But ultimately, it was only by 0.4 of a second. He didn't completely run away with it.
He did a massive wheelie at the end there over the line. All so right, it should have been a second or something.
A second,
like,
but it, yeah, it wasn't 5 seconds.
I hope he is listening to this podcast, because a big fan. Pecco, if you're listening, want to do an interview or something. Anyway, it was a good ride. It's just, it's not too little, because he did, you know, the 25 points, so that can't be too little. It's all he did, but it's too late. It's just too late. But it's a really good ride by the rider for all his errors and mishaps, and for all his occasional buckling under pressure. That maybe isn't even occasional. Maybe occasional is a very nice word to use there. But he is Ducati's best rider. It's just, you know, simple as that. He gets lap records on the regular. He's an absolute phenomenal performer in qualifying. I forgot the word phenom, so had to do phenomenal there. He's quick. He's really, really, really quick. So if there are days where Ducati's not going to regret trying to pursue somebody like Mir or Quartararo for one of their factory bikes for next year, it's days like this, because they'll see these performances from Bagnaia and they'll know that sooner or later he'll probably get us that crown.
I don't think he had any risk of buckling under pressure on Sunday, because there was no pressure to buckle under. He was managing the gap to a rookie whose sole purpose was just to get that bike over the line and get his first podium. You know, the rookie is one of his best friends in the form of Marco Bezzecchi. There was no real desire to do anything risky or stupid behind. Yeah, that yesterday was about as low risk, low pressure a situation, I think, as you could hope for in the current MotoGP grid to win a race in. And I have to admit, I think Bagnaia was gifted it. I don't see a situation in which he would have fought for a win had Espargaro and Quartararo not come together. He had the pace for pole position, just phenomenal pace for qualifying, but I don't think he had the race pace. And I think he would probably have finished third or long distance behind the two of them, but that's the best he could have hoped for.
We haven't seen anybody try to pass him. So that's, you know, that's sort of part of where I'm wondering how it would have been. But through that final sector, I think it would have been quite doable. Just looking at how Espargaro went through some of the other Ducatis with relative ease, just setting it up through the fast corners to the point where you already arrive at Gerrit Timmer right on their rear wheel. And then it's easy from there, basically. But it, you know, it would have been interesting. I don't think he would have won. After the race, I was thinking, well, Bagnaia didn't really have to show his full pace, so maybe he could have still done it. But just listening to him after the race, and the fact that clearly it was weighing on his mind that he couldn't afford to crash again today, I don't think he would have won. But it, you know, it's nice for Lady Luck to turn to him for a change. Too. That's, you know, return the favor for the Nakagami bowling of Barcelona.
He did clearly have something in the bag more than what we saw, because there was a stage where Bezzecchi sort of started to close the gap a little bit, and yeah, Bagnaia just responded just ever so slightly, yeah, eased it back out again, and just sort of said, nah, we're not going to do anything stupid today. So there was more pace there to, yeah, play for, you know, that he didn't need to use. But yeah, I don't think he had the pace for the top three, or the top two, sorry, to take it.
Ultimately, Aleix closed on him by 6 seconds while having to overtake 10 yeah, bikes.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's pretty simple.
Exactly.
You know, the truth table will, of course, say about Bagnaia that the last six races, he's won three, not finished three. So as long as he gets to the line, he's halfway there, isn't he?
Which is Ducati's whole problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is why 66 points behind the leader of the World Championship. Still doable, but he needs a downhill following win, doesn't he?
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, I know that like there's been a desire on our end to cast Bagnaia as something of a disappointment, I think. That he's, you know, he buckles too much, he makes too many mistakes. But if you go 2 or 3 years back and you go, there's going to be like five race stretches where Bagnaia wins three of them, it'd be quite something. wouldn't it? He's still very new. He's still got room to grow. And ultimately, Ducati has bet right on him. It's just whether, the question is whether it's like it's got another bike that it should have placed somebody more proven on or not. That's my whole thing. I'm not like, I don't have an issue with Pecco. I think Pecco's excellent. Even when he crashes, I think he's already better than we may have expected him to be coming out of Moto2, for instance.
And I think that race is proof in itself of why Ducati have gotten rid of one of their factory riders and kept their other. Because Bagnaia still has that room to go, whereas the Jack Miller mistake that cost him third, and then eventually, you know, cost him fourth and fifth as well in the last sort of lap and a half, was just textbook Miller. You could have predicted that Jack would try to overtake a turn one going way too, you know, at his first chance of being able to make an overtake. And he's going way too hot and run wide. It's, you know, he's had 7 years to learn that and still hasn't.
Which actually is leading into what I was going to say. You know, Quartararo and Bagnaia have had the same amount of experience in MotoGP, but one of them came into MotoGP with all the success that Bagnaia had had, and Quartararo had won one Grand Prix. Yeah, so, and now look how it's changed.
One and a half,
yeah.
One race in a disqualification.
So on paper, when we started that rookie season for the pair of them, it was like, oh, Bagnaia's going to run away. How times they do a change.
Yeah, we all expected Bagnaia to be rookie of the year that season. But when we talk about the ultimate MotoGP thing, I think we talk about the talent ceiling, which you look at the outright best performances somebody has showed in any junior class. And I think what Fabio produced in SevMoto3 for two consecutive years, I think still, in terms of like pure talent, I think there was always the expectation that he has something more than Pecco. And maybe with Pecco, that like his Moto2 title was good. He proved himself as a MotoGP rider who can do really good things. But it was a fairly narrow win over Miguel Oliveira, I believe. So I don't think there was this conviction that he could be an absolute top-level stud rather than just a good MotoGP rider. And I think he is a stud. I think he's got insane potential. And he, you know, he gets lap records every single weekend. So I think that's something to admire from Ducati and from him.
Let's not forget the Spanish Moto3 class is probably the second most competitive class in the world after Moto3. And he won it at 14.
Yeah.
And then won it again at 15. Like, the talent that he showed at a very early age was absolutely undeniable.
Now that's a very, very good point, Simon. And thank you for reminding us.
You can plot through a very rocky road of bad decisions and awful teams that led him to being a mediocre Moto2 rider on a speed up. You know, not in a Calyx, on a speed up. You can kind of plot the trajectory to there through injury and all sorts.
Or budget.
Not even budget, because he started with Estrella Galicia. But then he had that bad injury and, you know, a lot went wrong. Went wrong. And it, you know, it would have been a shame if he'd never been given the chance that we're now seeing him have. But the talent, my point is the talent was always there from day one.
No, that's a very, very good point about the CEV, the Spanish Championship. So then, the championship table is Quartararo leading by 21 points, not 34, ahead of Aleix Espargaró. Johann Zarco, we'll touch on him later. He's still in third position, 58 points back of the leader. And Bagnaia, as I said a moment ago, 66 points back of the championship leader now that we're into the second half of the championship.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
So Quartararo, he made the mistake. He lunged alongside Aleix Espargaró into the left-hander. He said after the race, I thought there was an opportunity to do that. I thought there was a gap. I thought that I could get through there. But by the time I came round the next time round, I was too far back, but I committed myself and I went down the road. I threw my hands in the air. I was screaming at the television, no, because he doesn't do those mistakes. On a regular basis. I know he didn't finish in at the end of last year. Where was it? Almeria in Portugal or something or other. But it's rare that that happens. He potted round. I thought, keep going. It might rain. There was a little bit of rain eventually. He came in. I'd love to know what that conversation was with his crew chief. But they quite rightly said, get back out. But of course he looped it again. Maybe a rear sensor was damaged, bit of traction control. It didn't look right.
Yeah.
But he was flipping lucky that he didn't hurt himself, because if he'd hurt himself on the second time around, everybody would have just laughed like he was a clown. And that's a strong thing to say, because he's not a clown. But that was worrying from my point of view.
Yeah, 2 points there. First of all, I felt like a clown because I've spent the last 15 podcast episodes saying he never crashes, and he did it.
And me.
Yeah, he did it twice in one race, and at least one of those crashes was really dumb, and it's the first one, not the second one. So when he came in, what he's told, and what you could read between the lines, that he was not happy with his crew at all for sending him out again on what was an apparently damaged bike. Because he wanted to park it, but they said, but what if rain comes in, just, you know, poodle around, then come in for the rain bike if that happens. Not only did the rain not properly arrive, but apparently there was a TC failure or something like that. You could see from the crash that it looked weird. You could see from the crash that the bike wasn't all okay. And it was I understand why they sent him out, but at the same time, you could also very successfully argue that it's a stupid risk to take for 1 or 2 points when you've got a big championship lead, because he had a big fall, and that could have been a lot worse than it was. And he still went to the medical center, but if he broke a collarbone or something, I don't know. Is that second crash, he needs to discuss with Yamaha. It's pretty clear. That first crash, he needs to just never do that again. Easier said than done, but it's rubbish. It's not good.
The first crash was, it was a dumb error. And I think it maybe hints at the fact that he is feeling under pressure from Aleix more than anyone else, that he felt the need to make a move that he wouldn't have made in anyone else on Aleix at that point in the race. The second crash was entirely Yamaha's fault, as far as I'm concerned, and the team need to have a good hard look at themselves, because they did the fundamental error of second-guessing the rider. Fabio came into the garage and told them that the bike wasn't fit to ride, and they sent him back out in a damaged bike. The bike had a broken sensor, traction control didn't work, he came around the corner, he got in the gas, there was no traction control, and the high side was inevitable. So the team second-guessed their rider. You can't do that whenever the rider is saying this bike isn't fit.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before, and I've written about it before for the race. I'm of the opinion that MotoGP should have a BSB rule where if you crash, you don't restart, because no one ever actually gains anything from restarting in a MotoGP race after a crash. Val is waving his hands frantically.
But no.
Val, I've never seen him so animated.
Paul Valencia 2019 in the wet crashed, remounted, finished.
But one example.
I see what you mean. But I just,
when it's something we see happen on a regular, you know what I mean. That's my the fact that there's one case that stands out.
Absolutely.
And I think that only happened because they red flagged the race.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So I that could have been a lot worse yesterday, that second crash, because that high side was nasty. High sides are so much nastier than low sides anyway. And when it's something unexpected, like a fundamental component of the bike just not working, You know, it's the equivalent of the front wheel falling out, isn't it? These days, the traction control is that important.
Yeah, well, spindle not being attached.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's all just wrong. Yeah, yeah. Now, we're in 2022. It's different from 2002. We were all watching the television thinking, now, is he going to get a penalty for that? And then the news, the ticker flashed up, oh, we're going to look into this after the race. And I thought, that's a bit rich. They're not going to commit. And then ultimately, come Sunday evening, they have given Fabio Quartararo a long lap penalty for the next Grand Prix, which is at Silverstone at the end of August. And hang on a minute, Val, can you just give me a hand here? Because we just need to ratchet strap Simon down for just a moment. So the stewards have given him a one lap penalty, a long lap penalty, should I say. But being serious for a moment, from my point of view, if somebody like Taka Nakagami had done it, who's maybe a bit of a live wire, like him as we do in the paddock, would the world be pointing a finger at him and going, well, you're the paddock hooligan, it's always you, kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely.
But of course, Quartararo is not the paddock hooligan. But likewise, he shouldn't be given special dispensation because he's leading the championship. Is there any champion? I disagree with those kind of things. So a few people have said, like Mauro Maragalli in Yamaha, the penalty was severe and incoherent. Chaz Davis, FIA MotoGP stewards panel, doing an excellent job of deterring riders from actually racing in the future. Valid point, Chaz. A basic failure to recognise an unfortunate racing incident versus a blatant reckless riding incident. Everybody's got a view on hindsight. It's life. The good thing is, morally, the good thing is, Quartararo went into Aleix Espargaró's garage after the race. I'm sorry. And there wasn't a bad feeling between them. It's life. But it's opened the snake pit again, hasn't it? So, Simon, should we go with you first?
Val, knowing what's coming next for me, has asked for if he can go first on this one.
Oh, okay. Okay, right. Over to you, Val.
Oh, boy. Okay, so, man, a few points there. One is, I think when you discussed how Fabio, whether he was feeling the pressure or not, Simon, I actually think he was having one of those. Remember Marc Marquez at Argentina, where he felt he was entitled to pass everybody really easily, and he rammed off first Rossi and then Espargaro. It wasn't the same. Yeah. It wasn't the same level of aggression or recklessness, but I think it was a very similar mindset. Like what Aleix alluded to is that Fabio's riding so high, a wave of confidence, that he just feels that others need to get out of the way, and he owes it to himself to get him out of the way as soon as possible. Now, with that cleared off, I do have issues with how the situation was handled a bit, that I don't really understand why it was investigated after the race. I'm not really sure what the pattern there is and how it's decided. Whether did they need to hear from Fabio? Did they need to see the data, I guess? But that doesn't seem to stop him in some of the other occasions. But that said, and Simon will attest to this, when the news of the long lap penalty came in, I was like, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that makes sense to me. And apparently, and I was really, really surprised, not because I'm very arrogant and think I'm always correct or whatever, but I was really surprised that there was a lot of controversy about this. Because to me, it felt like, yeah, he messed up. That's a penalty. He did a dumb lunge that backfired and it hindered the race of another competitor. I don't really see what's the big deal. Now, clearly a lot of people have seen the big deal. So I need to rethink my approach in this sort of topic, and also not cause a screaming match here. But I also should say, and before we hand over to Simon, that Chaz Davies' point about discouraging racing, I think it's total nonsense. Not like I've never heard of riders feeling discouraged from trying dumb overtaking moves by stewards' interference. Genuinely, I've never heard a single rider or a single driver in Formula One talk about it. Something riders and drivers always say that, ooh, harsh stewarding, it's going to discourage racing, nobody's going to race anymore. And it's always just, I've always found it to be doom-mongering, completely not true. But, yeah, go for it, Simon. Let's go. Let's dance.
So, I've got 2 points, and none of them are whether or not Fabio Quartararo deserved a penalty. The first one is that Quartararo got a penalty for that move but 2 weeks ago, Takanakagami didn't get a penalty for a similar move.
I was just about to say.
Jack Miller knocked off Juan Mir in Portimao this year. He didn't get a penalty. In Qatar last year, Jack Miller ran Juan Mir off the track deliberately and didn't get a penalty for it. Yet in Moto 3, we see riders make genuine racing incidents where they make contact with a rider they didn't know that was even there because of positioning and viewpoints and whatever, and they're immediately given a penalty there and then in the race. Stewarding cannot be luck of the draw. It can't be pluck a penalty out of the bag, do it whenever you want, make it up as you go along, because that's just not how the rule of law is applied. You can't just willy-nilly decide on the sanction, the level of the sanction, and when you apply the sanction, depending on what mood Freddie Spencer's in that day. That's just not how it's done. It's not done that way. Referees don't give red cards in soccer after the game. They don't award, they don't bring all the players onto the field at the end of the game and say, oh, we've decided to give you a penalty now. You know,
that's actually happened in the Premier League.
I think we're back to exception now, that you know what I mean. Yeah. But it's not. Stewarding needs to be done fairly, and whenever it feels like it's being made up as they go along in every single situation, it isn't fair. You know, we saw riders in Moto 3 yesterday given long lap penalties for incidents on track, but they were given the penalty there and then in the race. They served the penalty in the race and they rejoined the race. Quartararo could in theory have served his long lap penalty yesterday from 24th place.
Yes.
If the Absolutely. Rules had been consistently applied across the day in the three classes. But they're not.
Which is why I thought they sent him out.
Yeah, I did have an idea that that might be a part of it, yeah.
And it wouldn't happen at Silverstone, which would matter.
Yeah. And that's the fundamental issue here. It's the fact that the stewards just make it up as they go, seemingly. That there is just this complete lack of consistency. You know, I've argued for years and years that the best stewards cannot be motorbike racers, because motorbike racers aren't qualified to be stewards. And this is further proof of it, because, you know, we're potentially in a situation now where if Quartararo finishes second, not first at Silverstone because of this, because of the long lap penalty he has to serve, and then he loses the championship in Valencia by 4 points, Yamaha could be looking at a court of arbitration for sport case to decide the title, because the stewarding hasn't been consistently applied across the season. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it's the sort of thing that they're setting themselves up for.
I think it is a question of transparency that you say that. We do, like, I think the transparency has gotten a little bit better these last couple of weeks, in that there's more detailed decisions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
There is.
But they do need to explain why it was investigated after the race.
Well, we say there are more detailed decisions. There are decisions that come from decisions they know were... There are more detail comes to decisions they know are going to get attention. We've had more detail in Nakagami, and we've had more detail in Quartararo. We've noted more detail in any of the Moto 3 incidents that have similarly left people befuddled. And in theory, we need that, like, 3 or 4 paragraphs of description
from
every penalty if we're to understand their logic behind the bigger picture, because it's about the bigger picture.
I think they need to explain why it was a post-race investigation. Yeah. I think...
Yeah, exactly.
I think it is too much luck of the... I'm still bewildered that, the Mir Miller thing in Qatar didn't yield anything. I'm still bewildered that the Nakagami thing didn't yield anything. I think... Just thinking about it, because we haven't heard from the stewards, obviously, but thinking about it more and more, I can kind of see the logic. I don't agree with it at all, but I can kind of see the logic where the Nakagami crash doesn't bring a penalty and the Quartararo crash does. And in that, if you, like, Zapruder the Nakagami incident, you look at it over and over again, the stewards could get themselves to think that by that point he had completed his overtaking maneuver, and then he just got the braking into turn one wrong, irrespective of whether or not he was trying to pass a rider, whereas Quartararo specifically erred in trying to pass a rider. It's flimsy logic. I don't like it.
He got his braking. No, I am going to interrupt you. He got his braking wrong and then really, because he was going too fast. Quattararo,
that is. Yes, no, but I mean...
Nakagami too.
For Quattararo...
they were the same thing.
What I'm trying to say is for Quattararo, it happened while completing an overtaking lunge from behind. Whereas for Nakagami, he just messed up turn one. He was going to try to pass two riders, but he wasn't coming from behind, if that makes sense. Devil's advocate. I'm just trying to figure out.
I agree. You two are very into it, and particularly, well, the pair of you, you see all the decisions, you see all the Moto 2 decisions. I look at it a bit further back, which is, has this bloke got form? What's his part? What's his nature? What's he like when he's in the steward's room? And if he hasn't been in for a while, doesn't that say something? And it's a qualitative judgment, not a quantitative judgment. And that's where this whole discussion comes from. It is a human judgment that is being given out as a penalty or not a penalty. And it's very frustrating and it gets a lot of blood pressure up and takes a lot of minutes on our podcast. But I just look back and go, what happened to Marco Simoncelli at Le Mans in 11? They just took him in and went, just flipping calm down, will you? And BSB do this, you know, it's the, just go and have a chat, just cool it and whatever. But they don't need to have a chat with Quattararo. Maybe I'm wrong, and this is the first of many lunging incidents, but I'll tell you what, I'll put a big bet on the table, as I'm sure you all will, and go, this is a one-off. I just want to look at the bigger picture, and I just think it's a bit strong.
In the context of the bigger picture, look at it from this way. On Saturday in qualifying, Jack Miller did something really dumb. He rejoined on a crashed bike that he had no need to be on track in the final minute of qualifying on a bike he wasn't going to restart on. And he almost had a really fast collision with Maverick Vinales. He got a long lap penalty for it, same as Quattararo. That's the third time this year Miller's been sanctioned for something.
Yeah.
And there was the incident with Mir at Portimao that everyone expected him to be sanctioned for and he wasn't. So that's his fourth offence this year.
That's his form.
And yet he's not having anything done to him to make him, you know, under the old penalty point system, he would be back of the greater race ban now. But because we scrapped the penalty point system, there's no, and this goes to the consistency of stewarding, there's no repercussions for multiple offences anymore.
This makes a really good case for the penalty point system, which would accomplish what Toby wants without leaving it as open as to personal biases, which obviously always exist. Like, you don't want stewards going, oh, this guy's kind of rude and obnoxious, so he gets a slightly bigger penalty. But I think penalty points protect against that a little bit.
Can you imagine if you've been driving on the public highway anywhere in the world for 35 years and you break the speed limit by 3 miles an hour or 5 kilometres in a town, 30 miles an hour, 50 clicks or whatever, for the first time in your life at 35 kilometres, but you get 6 months driving ban?
Yeah, the same as the guy from the next village over who's just been done for drink driving for the second time.
Yeah. No. I was going to say, Simon, who's got the points? You know, it's 3 points here, 3 points there, 3.9, 3 points, you're banned. So you've got 4 sets. That's the way I look at it. In the UK, at least, I don't know where it is in the rest of the world, that's the way it works. And you get a telling off, you have to go to the driving instruction course, you get penalty, you have to pay more on your insurance, and all that kind of stuff when you're on the public highway. That's what I advocate in MotoGP, and I thought that it worked when we had a penalty point system in MotoGP. But we mustn't talk too long because we've got other people to talk about. But that's just my 10 penneth.
I would say that my problem with that comparison in this particular case, not in general, but in this particular case, is I don't think what Quartararo did is a minor offence.
Okay.
I found it to be major. Okay. I thought what he did was majorly wrong and deserved a sanction beyond just retiring from the race. But that said, I also would like with the Miller point, the other problem with it is Jack Miller has not shown much in the way of repentance for his sanctions. He always does not agree.
Yeah.
He has never gone up and gone, yeah, that, you know, that was deserved, which also maybe should play into it a little bit, because then he's just going to keep approaching it the same way he's approaching, which Jack is not like, he's not a problem. He's not a menace. I'm not trying to say he's like a menace or out of control, but there's been enough incidents to where it needs a closer look. And yeah, again, the penalty point system, the unfortunate casualty of Sepang in Valencia 2015, maybe with a rethink and a revamp and like a lot of time spent looking at it, I think it could be quite useful. Yeah.
So just 2 points, because I'm aware that no one wants to listen to me ramble about penalty points and whatever for too long. One is, I think that one change that could be made right away is that the long lap loop should not be something that's awarded mid-race, because then it's a non-appealable penalty. By all means, keep it, but award it after the race. Don't award it mid-race. Make all decisions after the race, and then at least you're creating some fairness, unless it's something like a ride through or a jump start. Jump starts are different.
But what if, let's say, imagine that Quartararo-Espargaró thing happens for like first place, right? And Quartararo is the one who stays on and goes on to win the race. I think MotoGP has within its interest to prevent guys who have made an offense.
Do what they used to do and award a 3 second penalty.
Okay, fair enough.
You know what I mean? It just the instant penalty with no option for recourse or appeal, I don't like.
I agree.
Make all decisions post-race, and then there's an element of fairness that's introduced immediately.
And it also allows you to penalize people who have already ruined their race, which I think is important.
Exactly. But the bigger picture, to wrap up the whole thing here, is just, I love Assen. I love going to Assen. We had four phenomenal races this weekend. Moto 3 was incredible. Moto 2 unusually was incredible. The Moto E races were fantastic.
Yeah.
The MotoGP race was fantastic. And it's post-race and everyone's talking about the stewards again.
That's a shame.
Good stewards, good referees should not be mentioned in the media. And every weekend we end up talking about them. And it tires me and it frustrates me because it feels like it's draining all of the fun out of this amazing spectacle at the minute by just constantly having their decisions like this. It just...
And me being the older guy is, all of a sudden, we didn't talk about stewards much in 20 years ago.
Well, I made this point
earlier. Somebody was a complete buffoon like Caparossi skittling 6 people at the first corner at Motegi 1 year on a Duke. Okay, right, or somebody... It was few and far between, so is it just a thing of the third decade of the 21st century?
I made the point earlier, Toby, on Twitter that Rossi versus Gibernau, Jerez 2005, would have been a long lap penalty. Rossi against Stoner 2008, Laguna Seca, would have been a penalty.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Those iconic races wouldn't have existed as iconic races.
Here's me being... I don't know if I'm a millennial or whatever, but he's me being obnoxious. I think the Gibernau thing should absolutely have been a penalty. That is not a legitimate win in my book. So, whoops.
Right. Well, that's another hour of conversation, that is. Yeah.
That's a whole different podcast.
Yeah. The marshals sweeping up the glass bottles that were thrown onto the track after the race. That's how passionate that was. But anyway, okay, let's just take a break for a moment. Go and find yourself a drink. Get a nice biscuit, and we'll pick up with with what really happened in Assen in just a moment's time.
Just kidding, it's more Stewart's talk.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
A first for the VR46 MotoGP team was a podium at Assen. And how does he write the script that it's always at the cool circuits? Good old Valentino. He's still got the angel dust, doesn't he? Marco Bezzecchi coming home in second position, not a million miles away from the victory. I know it was about a second or so on the last lap. Bagnaia wheelied. He lost a bit of time, but ooh, can you imagine a first podium for Marco Bezzecchi as well? A little bit of rain, he said, not a problem for me. I almost enjoy it. I did not slow down. I would only slow down if the rain was beginning to hurt me on my neck. Brilliant. The celebration, the scenes of everybody outside that garage to going up towards Parc Fermé at the end of the race. That's what racing's all about. What a boy. Great. He got half a chance of a victory with a race like with a ride like that.
Yeah. I think if it rained a little bit more, I think he would have won. Honestly, I think if it rained just a little bit more, I think Bagnaia would have been a lot more shaken by it. And it does sound like Bezzecchi has something of a reputation for being very, very good in that kind of condition. Just it was a really good weekend. Yeah. I'm not sure we're going to spend as much time talking about it, say, the Gian Antonio poll, but that's that's only because it's more expected. Bezzecchi's had a really good season. He's had a really, really, really good season, and this is the icing on the cake. Qualified really well, helped by a tow from fellow Rossi protege Bagnaia, but still, you know, had to make Q2 and was clearly very competitive in Q2, tow or no tow. And then very smart, very good race with some overtaking and keeping his much more experienced fellow Rossi protege honest for so much of it while staying on the bike, which has been... We mustn't forget that Marco Bezzecchi comfortably leads the crash table in MotoGP this season. That's the one really problem with his rookie season, that he's written off a lot of Ducatis. But he's very good. He's been it's a great rookie season. I think with this he probably sues up rookie of the year, and it's well deserved because he might just turn out to be something special, Marco.
Yeah. So like you said, the celebrations in the garage, the reason why the VR46 guys always do well at cool circuits is because the VR46 guys are all clones of Valentino Rossi. And exactly. These are the tracks that he goes well at as well, because they're the old school, traditional, iconic venues. It was great to see the scenes in the garage. A little bit that might have slipped by on TV. There was a Dutch mechanic worked at Patronus called Robin Speechers. And Robin was on Valentino's side of the garage at Patronus, and went to VR46 after that team folded. And he's got a little tradition that I think is in the VR46 social media channels that he did yesterday as well, where there's one link in the chain on Bez's bike that's painted with a Dutch flag.
At every race?
No, at Assen.
Aww.
Only at Assen. And the Dutch flag got the podium yesterday. And I think it was Robin in the very center of the celebrations and everything like that, which was just, it was great to see. I don't think there's a world now in which Bez isn't on a Bastianini-esque career trajectory, where we see him podium a few more times this year and win a few races maybe before this year's out or at the start of next year. I think that's the path he's on. He is obviously a superstar. He is an awesome character for the sport because he is the most Valentino-esque of all of the VR46 riders in terms of personality and attitude and just happiness. He's a good guy, and I think he's going to do wonders for the sport, and I think he's going to, we're going to see him win races soon.
He's the one where they changed the genetic code the least while cloning.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay then, random subject change, but you'll get my thread. Val, what posters did you have up in your bedroom when you were growing up? Who was your hero? Just quickly.
All right. So REM, the 90s alt band.
Okay. Simon.
I wasn't really into posters. But
okay, who's
your hero? David Jeffries.
Oh well, you and me both. Yeah.
Who's my hero? Frank Lampard.
Okay, right. Okay. Yeah. For me, Keke Rosberg or Stephen Roach, cyclist. Right. But can you imagine having those posters on your wall and then playing in the REM band, Val, playing in the football team,
yeah.
Simon going to win the TT like David, me cycling in the same team that was being run by Stephen Roach. That's what Bezzecchi's going through. Yeah. I mean, it's just beyond a fairy tale. Can you imagine what it feels like? He must be, right, of course he's got his serious moments. He walks to the garage and this is work. I've got to get it right. I've got to speak to the data engineers. And then, are they paying me to do this?
I'm not sure Bez has many serious moments.
All right, then.
I just a side note, you've made me imagine being booed off the stage because I'm butchering Losing My Religion. So, which we can have as a bonus episode if people like.
But you wouldn't butcher it because you'd be good at it, like Bezeki is. I think it's a great story. And as he says, you know, he got the yellow flag on the cooldown lap. One of the marshals had it, and he said, "For me, he is my icon. He is my idol." Well. We have to go a long way for these kind of stories to happen again in MotoGP, I think.
My favourite Bez moment of late was, so all the riders now come to the media centre to do their media debriefs in the evening, which is so much easier. And we were in Sachsenring last weekend, and Pecco had just finished his media debrief and was sort of quite dejected about life and was standing eating a hot dog off a plate, and Bez arrived. And Bez was just standing talking to him. We were sort of watching from a distance. I don't know what... Pecco said to Bez or vice versa, but Pecco just absolutely threw his arms around him and gave him this big hug while Pecco had a mouthful of hot dog. And it was just a very humid, very, very honest moment from Bez. It was kind of very indicative of what he's actually like as a person.
Yep. They're a cool bunch, the VR46 guys. They're all really, really quite sweet lads, yeah. I think.
They are going to win a MotoGP race. They have won a Moto2 championship. They are going to win a Moto2 race, a MotoGP race. And I don't care how old Valentino will be, you know, there'll be still something that he will be doing in motorsport when he's 74 years old. And it'll still be as cool as when he won Assen on a 125 in 1997. It's just, he's got the angel dust. Brilliant. Just brilliant. Okay, we mustn't forget, in all of this, stewards, people knocking each other off, Bagnaia winning the race, ? Vinales. I've not rated the bloke. I've not been a fan of Maverick Vinales of late. And there he is. He's third on the podium. It proves again what Aleix Espargaró could have done yesterday. I eat a large slice of humble pie and I'll have a bit of cream, please.
Remember post-Sachsenring me saying that Maverick Vinales is 2023 MotoGP champion? Clearly I'm correct. Clearly it's happening. Obviously.
Right, cut him off again. Okay. Where's the button? Cut him off. Simon, please, cut him off.
This is not betting advice, please, guys. Just remember, don't do it. But he's good. He's you know, we've always known Maverick Vinales is capable of something special. And he's still nowhere near his peak on that Aprilia. I think his peak is much, much more than that. And if he reaches it, then we'll have a super fast guy who maybe is still a little bit of a weird confidence machine, to where if a weekend goes wrong, it goes really wrong. But at the same time, does not crash. Oh, last time I said that, it cost Fabio to crash twice. But Vinales has zero crashes this season. None. So that's quite something, right? And it's just, it's a trend through his career. He stays on bikes. So I think he could be a serious factor in 23, genuinely.
Yeah, me too. I think that he, like, we have to look at him now and say, well, this guy is delivering on exactly what he said he was going to deliver on and the way he said he was going to do it. He's building himself up. He's slowly converting himself to Aprilia style. Exactly like he said, on roughly the timeline he said he was going to do it on. But the moment for me on Sunday that really encapsulated everything more than anything else is he was in the winner's enclosure, just finished his TV interviews, and Aleix Espargaró came to see him. And the two of them had just this long, long hug where they were talking, whispering in each other's ears. And that's the reason that Vinales is suddenly fast now. He was never not fast. He was on the podium in pole position here last year at Assen on a Yamaha with a team that he despised. But he's found someone that loves him now, and that makes all the difference. And yeah, I can't see it going any way but up from here on in. He is going to be a massive threat. And if you do want MotoGP betting advice, let me direct you towards former John McPhee Jake Dixon and Ayumu Sasaki crew chief Mark Woodage, aka Brains, who put a £5 bet on Saturday that Sasaki would be top three, Dixon would be top three, and Maverick would be top three.
Ooh,
and
walked away with smoke.
Walked away with £1,047 from his £5 bet.
Ooh. That's a good bet. That's yep. A man who knows his stuff.
I'm not a betting man.
Yeah.
I'm not a betting man, but that's good going. Yeah.
That's I'm good less going. Impressed by the money than I am by, like, that's just, it's just cool. Really cool.
Right. Well, we better find out what hotel he's staying in at Silverstone so that he can buy the beer.
He's going to love this because he knows he listens and he's going to love what I'm about to say, but he's working in British Supersport this year and massively wasted as one of the unfortunate casualties of the fallout of the Patronus mess.
He said massively wasted. I thought he was working well under the influence.
He will be next week, Ed, once that bet clears.
Oh dear. KTM haven't had a great run, have they? I bumped into Danny Pedrosa at Goodwood. We had a bit of a catch up. I'll keep some of the conversation to ourselves because I don't want to put him in the poo, shall I say. But Brad Binder, yeah, he again Mr. Sunday, fifth position. What did he say in his debrief by the time he was upstairs in the press office?
He, in theory, actually, Brad was on for a pretty good race on Sunday. It looked like he was going to be fourth until the last 100 metres. And he did say afterwards, whenever he was asked about whether or not Alesha's pass on him and Jack Miller was over the line, he was like, hats off to the guy. That was fucking superb. That was just incredible. So it wasn't a terrible weekend for them. Oliveira, I think, was the most unfortunate because when Juan Mir activated his hole shot device on the grid, he braked very unexpectedly. Oliveira ran into them and took all of the wings off one side of the bike. So he was basically neutered from the beginning, and to finish ninth with a bike on at Assen, of all places, with a bike that was pulling to one side. Yeah, no, I think he did quite well, actually, in the end. Same thing happened Luca Marini, actually, who made contact with Rins after the lights went out, took off all the wings.
It was Mir. It was Mir again.
Mir again.
Yeah.
So
a mega run from Oliveira to ride that much of a stricken motorcycle, to be only 8 seconds off the victory. Marini, 30 seconds off the victory. Doesn't that maybe say, we're going to start the discussion, do we really need these wings? If they're 30 seconds slower, is that taking the show away?
Not. I mean, we don't really need them, but that's a whole different podcast.
Yeah, I think more of the discussion is you don't want a device that makes people break super hard on the grid because that's not good. I thought Binder sounded a lot more alive after the race than he had for a while, because I think the consistent underperformance of the KTM in qualifying and having to do massive salvage jobs, I think, was getting to him. And this time they weren't great in qualifying, but they were much better than the previous rounds, and that set him up for a competitive race for meaningful positions. And I think he sounded like, with Brad, he's never like surly like some of the other riders get surly. Like, the way you interpret it is the more PR-ish his answers are, the more unhappy with things he is. And like, for he showed a lot of character after that Assen ride. So I think he needed that, even if it's not fourth, it's fifth. Yeah. I think he needed
The other thing is Remy Gardner kind of hinted that the new parts, the new chassis and swing arm that they tested in Barcelona at the test, that seemed to make a big difference. I think when we come back after the summer break, KTM will be bringing 8 of those along, and maybe a slightly refined version of them that they're hoping, you know. Let's not forget that last year they had a dire start to the season. They brought a new chassis to Mugello and then they went in a winning streak.
And then again, more bad.
Yeah, I know. And then again, it went down again. But if that winning streak only starts after the summer break, at least hopefully, you know, they can end the year a bit more positive than they did last year. But there is something coming that might make things a bit better for them.
I was at Goodwood and at the weekend, and I was about 5-10 minutes away from the hill climb. And I just came into a village, and there was the village sign on the left-hand side of the road, and it had a 33 Brad Binder sticker on it, quite big, kind of about 15 centimetres square. And I thought, did I just see that? What, that was the 33, the BB, the colours of the South African flag. And I went, that was. So I went through the village and I looked in my rear mirror when I exited the village. There was another one on the sign going the other way because the village was called Binderton.
Super cool.
So if you're listening and you put that sticker on the sign, fair play, you got yourself a mention. That's really fun, really cool. Well, at least they got a corner named after Valentino at Silverstone already.
Hey.
Yes.
Yeah, club.
Yeah, for the VR 46 Academy.
You've got it. Talking about Goodwood, Wayne Rainey, Kenny Roberts, Mick Doohan, Kevin Schwantz, Jeremy McWilliams. We've all seen the pictures, we've seen the video. My goodness me, the images, the emotion of the 1992 world champion there with Nigel Mansell, who won the Formula One title in the same year, photos together, the sun was shining, the colour of that red on the Marlboro Yamaha, just out of this world. I do want to give a mention to a guy called David Dew, and David pulls together all the motorcycles and all the superstars for Goodwood. For the revival, for the Festival of Speed. And if it wasn't for David, who we've worked with in the MotoGP paddock in years past, he was the press officer for Repsol Honda, Nicky Hayden, when he won the championship in the mid-zeros. Just, if you're listening.
And who's back in the MotoGP press office at the minute, back in the MotoGP Media Center, working with Triumph on their MotoGP project.
He's got an agency. They're busy in the world of mainly of two wheels. But Dave, well done. It's all down to you that you pulled these names together. Absolutely fantastic. Brilliant to see. Okay, now we're coming into the summer break. 5 weekends without a MotoGP race. So we've got a few podcasts lined up that we are going to pull together before we get to Silverstone at the end of August. Do continue to send in your questions, your little voice messages to podcasts@the-race.com. We did a podcast the other day, a couple of editions ago, going through a dozen of your questions. So give us a good one and then we will pick it out. In the meantime, we've got one question as to answer today.
Hi, this is Lavinia from Romania. I was wondering, how do you explain Aleš's race from Assen? I mean, where did he find the extra resources from? He's competing with the best riders of the world, yet he made them look like amateurs on a Saturday track day. P.S. I still remember the surprise one of you had when, at the beginning of the year, he said he saw himself as a championship contender.
Hi, Lavinia. Well, you can't really blame us, can you? He had no MotoGP wins before this year, no wins in any class, no, I think, one podium in the Premier class. Like, none of us thought he was bad. We were gushing about him for a fairly long time, but it's just, it's a big step to go from that to title contender. As to the question itself, I think, this is my viewpoint, I don't think he found anything extra so much as I think he and Fabio were clear of the pack very comfortably, and Fabio knocked himself off. So Aleš, his pace was balanced just right to be able to take advantage of the Gürtimer chicane over and over and over again, because he was very comfortable through the high speed corners, which he said was down to the new side pod aero that Aprilia introduced in the Barcelona test, was it, or something like that?
Yep.
Yeah. And that was, that was a really, really big part of it. But also, it was just really good. We all expected the Aprilia to go quite well at Assen. I don't think we expected Aleš to be better than Maverick, because Maverick's so good at Assen, but apparently Aleš was. So, it was a weekend of excellent form, aided by a track configuration that suits the bike. Also, Aleš, I think, is historically pretty good at Assen. And also, he was really mad, and that appeared to help.
I did an interview at the very, very start of the season at Sepang Testing before we realized how good the new bike was with Aprilia boss Massimo Rivola. And he listed off all the circuits that were going to be targets for Aprilia this year, and Assen was number one on the list. So I think what we saw was a combination of a track that really suited the bike, a rider that loves the track, a rider that was angry. Never underestimate the power of anger. and just the fact that this season has been exceptional for Aprilia and that he's head and shoulders above the rest. Not head and shoulders above all of the rest, but head and shoulders above most of the rest. You know, he is statistically the second best rider in the championship at the minute. And the best rider in the championship is in the gravel.
Exactly. And when you're on form, it breeds confidence, and confidence breeds confidence, and effort, effort, effort. You just don't want to have too much confidence, because as Marc Marquez has discovered, that's when it gets very dangerous. Thank you, Lavinia, for your question. Do send in your other voice messages, podcasts@the-race.com. So keep in touch with the-race.com, with our website. We've got a lot of you coming in to read the stories, particularly in MotoGP, that have been put together by the team led by Simon and Val. So thank you, guys. There's lots of work that those two put in. So thank you so much. You do need a rest, Simon. Please do. Get in the van, get on the top of a mountain, look at the view and stop for a bit, because you do need to. Still a long way to go. In the meantime, we will be back next week with another MotoGP podcast. So it remains for me to say thank you, Val. Thank you, Simon. And we speak to you soon. Take care.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.